So when I mentioned the book of Ecclesiastes, when was the last time you heard a sermon out of the book of Ecclesiastes? We did a sermon series when I first got here called Overcoming Our Suburban Addictions, where we kind of did that. We got into, we used the book of Ecclesiastes for that. It's not one that comes up too often, probably more frequently than Leviticus or Numbers, but yeah, we've had some. So yeah, Todd, it's... there are times to go, times to come, and times to go. And for every season, turn. And that's good. that's a good sermon. I remember that there was a, I'm not going to get this right, there's a prayer that one of my friends who's a pastor was asked to come and pray for somebody in his congregation that was... I'm going to look it up right here while I'm talking to y'all about who was being, what's the word? He had been elected, so he was inaugurated into office for some statewide office, and he had this, my friend, who's a pastor, that he came and was able to pray for him, and he prayed using Psalm 109:8 that says, "Let his days in office be few." My friend did not want to pray at that service. He had some, but he mentioned, he used that to talk about wisdom, I think. But yes, you can do stuff like that when you're when you get in. There's some fun parts of Scripture. And what else? What else do you know about Ecclesiastes? I mentioned the book of Ecclesiastes. What else comes to mind? Okay, wisdom. Yeah, we're in the midst of wisdom literature. I'm sorry? Solomon? Yeah. There's a cynicism about it? Absolutely. There's a cynical viewpoint for the book. A couple other things. Any other things? About
vanity, meaninglessness.
Yeah. Yeah, vanity, meaninglessness. Sometimes I spend far too much time trying to find a good background for my slides, this one I chose because it represents the theme of the book, the idea, which we'll get into in here in a few moments, which is a main concept in the book, that Ecclesiastes is a book where we're exposed to what it is to pursue wind, grasping at wind. Or that life is vapor. It is something that's there and then is gone. This is the kind of the concept behind Ecclesiastes. And so we see that that is part of it. There's been a number of books. I remember there's, a book out there that I saw a couple years ago. It was about how you're going to preach to younger generations who are the post-everything world. And the central idea was books and passages like you'll find in Ecclesiastes resound with them, resound with folks in their 20s and 30s, and give a good template for moving forward with that. It was a really intriguing concept. But yeah, we've seen that. We've seen that that there is, the Ecclesiastes is a book that you get into, and you suspect because of its name that the book would be something about like church organization or something to do with, because of that ecclesia concept that's in the title there. But actually, the name of the book, Ecclesiastes, comes from the Greek translation of the author's name. And you'll see there that, let's step into that real quick. So the author is Colette, is what, that's how you pronounce that word. That's the Hebrew word that's used to describe the author. It is, and that the author, that basically what that means is it can mean a couple things. It's somewhat of a pen name, but it is probably a little bit more direct than that. This is the way that the author describes himself, and we read a little bit about that, and we'll touch on this a little bit more, but Colette is, and if you go into some more, some more rigorous commentaries or some more technical commentaries, you'll see that they will refer to the author specifically as Colette. And it's similar to this. If there's the Jewish commentary, there's actually a, I have on my shelf in my office a Jewish study Bible, which is a JPS version, which is Jewish Publication Society study Bible, and it's of the Old Testament. And in that study Bible, they have their own translation of the Old Testament. I think the last time they updated the JPS, it was 1985. But they in the study Bible, they actually refer to Colette and they use a K instead of a Q. You cannot use this word in Scrabble, just throwing that out there, because it is a proper name. But you can try, because you could say, well, it just means teacher. But because you're always looking for those Q words that don't need a U. Anyways, I always have fun with those. I haven't played Scrabble in a long time. People don't want to play me anymore, Rusty. It's rough. There's a track that's on your phone, Words with Friends. You can get into fights on airplanes over it. So Colette is what the author of the book calls himself. And we do know it's a man because of the way that he refers to himself and the way throughout. Being a man, I'll throw this out there, and this is a little bit controversial, I suppose, but I do believe that women can be a part of the inscripturation process and likely would have had their help in authoring and bringing together books of the Bible. We'll leave that where it is. But nevertheless, so Colette is a word in Hebrew. Now, it can mean one of two things. It can mean the word preacher. It could mean the word preacher. Because Colette is Colette is the word in Hebrew for assembly or gathering. That word is often translated in the Greek version of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, as ekklesia or ecclesia, depending upon where you want to put the right emphasis. But the thing about it is that it means assembly, and so the person that is there could be the preacher, but it's not inherently. It's not inherently a term that means preacher, but rather, so my take on it is that it is the formal identification of the author, and it means the teacher. I don't think that there's a religious connotation to the author of Ecclesiastes for a couple of reasons. One, because the book's just so depressing to read in some parts, and I think preachers shouldn't be depressing. But there's also the reality that if the person is who the person says they are, they weren't a spiritual leader. They were a political leader of Israel. And if you open to Ecclesiastes, or you just want to go there, in verse 1:1, we see the beginning of the book is kind of its superscript, or it is the title of the book, and it says, "The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem." The words of the teacher. Now, that teacher can have a couple of different connotations to it, so that's why I translate it as teacher. This is, this is one of the most diversely translated words, and particularly when it comes out of the English version, or English versions, because some of you will have the preacher, some of you might even have Colette, depending upon what translation you're working with. But the idea there, Colette, the teacher, and we see that in 1:1. We also see that in 1:12, where it says, "I, the teacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem." So what does that mean? It's a pretty specific identification. Now, last semester, when we were walking through the Minor Prophets, we talked a little bit about how some of the books are very ambiguous of the Old Testament as to who wrote them. This is not ambiguous because there's a writer that kind of signs their name on there. But what else do they describe themselves as? Well, we see this, son of David, king in Jerusalem, which leads us to believe that the person is Solomon and could be Solomon. Now, there are some conversations about this that go on in the literature. There are some conversations about that person's identification. And the challenge that you get into is some of the scholars that are out there, some of the commentators, will immediately challenge traditional authorship because they're in the middle. They always challenge traditional authorship. It's like when we get into Paul's letters. There's a group of Paul's letters that are called his main letters, or they're called Hauptbriefe in the technical literature, so main letters. And that really, it is a lot of his primary letters that we would suspect. Romans, 1st, 2nd Corinthians is in there, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, but Colossians really isn't in there. 1st, 2nd Thessalonians is in there. 1 Thessalonians is in there, maybe 2 Thessalonians. But then the pastoral epistles, 1, 2 Timothy, Titus, are not in there. And Philemon isn't necessarily in there. And there's some reasons that they challenge those books. And this is in the critical scholarship realm. I don't always necessarily agree with critical scholars. I think sometimes you've got to take a text for what it says and just recognize that we can't always know, but we can act with faith. But Solomon is considered traditionally, as we've noted in your notes and here on the screen, he's considered the traditional author of Ecclesiastes. Now, if you've read through Ecclesiastes, what's the character behind, or the person, how do they describe themselves in the book? Other than what I've already read, son of David, king in Jerusalem. How else do they describe themselves? Okay, it could be a little bit of that. It could be the idea that they have encountered a lot of emptiness in their life. But how else do they describe themselves? Yeah, he is. He's a rich man. Yeah, absolutely. He's wise. He's a rich man. You'll see that there are multiple places where the author describes the work that he had done, the things that he had done, that he'd built. Trying to find some real specific points that I can look at it. He had built gardens, he had built palaces, he had built a kingdom, frankly, and that it all was for naught. You'll notice that verse 13 of chapter 1, I applied my mind to examine and explore through wisdom all that is done under heaven. And it's a miserable task to do. So you get into some really interesting content right off the bat. Notice this, that in chapter 2, verse 4, this is probably one of the more specific identification points. I increased my achievements. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself and planted every kind of fruit tree, in them. I constructed reservoirs for myself from which to irrigate a grove of flourishing trees. I acquired male and female servants and had slaves who were born in my house. I also owned livestock, large herds and flocks, more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. I also amassed silver and gold for myself and treasure of kings and provinces. I gathered male and female singers for myself and many concubines, the delights of men. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also remained with me. And all, this is verse 10, all that my eyes desired, I did not deny them. I did not refuse myself any pleasure, for I took pleasure in all my struggles. This was my reward for all my struggles. And when I considered all that I had accomplished and all that I had labored to achieve, I found everything to be futile in a pursuit of the wind. After all of that stuff, the author finds it to be futile. Did exactly what everybody wants to do. This is one of the richest people that perhaps could have ever lived. Now, that identification leads us to believe that they were significant. Now, they could have been being dramatic, or they could have possibly been overemphasizing their actual wealth and who they actually were. But the question is, why would they do that? Why would they go and do it? Now, there is something to be said about contrasting this with the emptiness that they're going to describe, so it's a little bit of a play on words. But it leads us to consider that how they describe themselves. There are only a handful of people that could be like this, and there are also only a handful of people in the history of Israel, the nation of Israel, that could be like this. It couldn't be people that came after Solomon for any number of reasons, Rehoboam being one of them. would have had a challenge there. Because almost immediately once Solomon dies, what happens to Israel? Well, not immediately, but within a generation. Yeah, it splits into two. You got the northern kingdom and you have the southern kingdom. And over the course of multiple generations, the northern kingdom disappears. So 10 tribes in the north disappear, and then you're left with the two tribes in the south. And those two tribes of the south ultimately take over the identity after the Babylonian captivity coming back. And those two tribes taking that identity are then known as, they become one tribe, the Jews, or the Judites that are left in Palestine or Israel, and they ultimately reform the temple and are the people that are in and of the area of Israel in the first century. This would seem to be only a handful of people that we know about. So we're pretty sure that it's Solomon. So I'm going to refer to the person as Colette throughout the notes, but I will say that I affirm that it is Solomon. I think that it's Solomon. I think that if it's not Solomon, that you've got a really big problem. There are some things to be said about ways that they refer to themselves, some things that we find in the text, little pieces here and there, but ultimately we discover ourselves still having to answer the question, if it's not Solomon, then who could it be? If it's not Solomon, who's another option? Because it can't be a pagan king. It couldn't be somebody who's outside of Israel because they wouldn't have accepted him. But there are some challenges to that picture of the Solomonic authorship of Ecclesiastes and so forth. So that's kind of gives you a little bit of a conversation point there. It just, the way that these Old Testament books go, the way, frankly, any biblical book goes, it's really hard, especially though it seems the ones that they like to state who wrote it, they have a tendency to want to go after it. Now, what's intriguing there is if you look at Ecclesiastes 1:1, and then you page over or do whatever you can to get to Proverbs 1:1, notice this, the words of the teacher, son of David, king of Jerusalem, that's Ecclesiastes 1:1. Proverbs 1:1 says this, the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. So you're running into similar language being used. Now, it could be that, and there is a hypothesis out there that the text of Ecclesiastes comes together over a couple of generations because there are a couple parts. The challenge with that is the language, the words, the concepts are very consistent all the way through. Now, the way that that can go is that could ultimately be an editor that comes along a little bit later and changes them out, or editors that come and gloss everything over. We've talked about that as we talked about Proverbs and so forth. So a little bit on the authorship, probably a little too much on the authorship. Let's look at the date. Again, if this is Solomon, then traditionally it's going to be around the 10th century B.C. But the critical scholars, the ones who would challenge that Solomon is the author, will put it around 250 B.C. And the reason that they build this on is there's a lot of, the technical term is post-exilic language, and that is language that comes in, concepts that come in after the return of the Babylonian captivity, after the walls of Jerusalem are rebuilt by Nehemiah, after Ezra's reforms are put into place, in that period. There's some challenges, some really good challenges to it. I don't want to dig around too much on it, but there are some problems with it. The date traditionally, though, again, around the 10th century B.C., we would put it in approximation to when Proverbs is written, or at least compiled somewhere around the same era, and probably began being circulated, was probably updated. This is kind of a nerd note. That's actually something I should use for more and more. This is kind of a little off thing. The text of Ecclesiastes, the actual Hebrew text, is something that is rather well founded. There's not a lot of variants that are found in different manuscripts, that is, differences. There are some scribal things that happen. What's intriguing about it is some portions of Ecclesiastes have been found in the Qumran scrolls. And the Qumran caves, and it's such an interesting thing. That whole process with Qumran is really something that's pretty fascinating and has happened in many of our lifetimes, and we're continuing to find stuff. What's really intriguing about the Qumran stuff now, and this will be a little bit of a side note, one of the things that we found when we were looking for more stuff on Ecclesiastes is we can use technology that we didn't have available to us in the 60s or even in the 50s and looking at ancient manuscripts, what they're able to do now is they're able to use laser technology, and they can go through and they can look at the different layers within a manuscript. And they've actually have, and you wouldn't believe me if you saw it, but you can imagine taking your newspaper that you get in the morning and rolling it up and tossing it in the fire. And the fire doesn't get hot enough to burn it all off, but so you got this like husk in there that's all kind of together. We can actually shoot stuff through it and do imaging through a couple different ways, and they're beginning to be able to pull out some of the letters that are behind decayed portions. And that's been a really intriguing thing. There's a second part of that. This is more about the New Testament thing. They're finding a lot of manuscripts that are part of funerary masks. Now, a funerary mask is exactly what it sounds like. They put it over the face of somebody who's dead and kind of as part of their funeral ritual that they would have had. But so they take these things off. Now, some of the more prominent people, pharaohs or major leaders or rich people that had these things made, it was interesting. They found a very old fragment from one of the Gospels a couple years ago. The challenge with that is, and this is part of the ethical conversation in archaeology, is that should we destroy the funerary mask to get to the manuscript? Ultimately, the good news is we don't have to do that as much. Just give science enough time or technology enough time and they'll find a solution. So anyways, so a little nerd note, the text of Ecclesiastes is fairly settled. And there's not a lot of question about what was going on with that. Anyways, genre of it, it's wisdom literature, as we've mentioned, but it's unique from Proverbs. The text is not necessarily poetic, but it's also not necessarily prose. It combines different elements of those genres to kind of get to its point. But what's intriguing about this is there's no specific parallel to the book of Ecclesiastes in the ancient Near East. So you look back even into the 10th century all the way forward to maybe the 5th or the 4th century BC, and you'll find that there's no parallels to how the book of Ecclesiastes exists. Now, there are aspects, and we see some places where there's alignment in concept with some older literature. But as we talked about a couple weeks ago, we talked about how Proverbs carries in and brings in some different kinds of literature from the ancient day, from the ancient Near East. Ecclesiastes kind of stands on its own, which is really unique. It is one of the most unique books you'll ever encounter, and particularly within the text of the Old Testament, it is one of the most unique books in all of the Old Testament. So for what it's worth with that. Main scripture, I always try to include this because I think it's a good idea to try to look at kind of what's out, what gives you the big idea of the book. Well, really, it's the first chapter and the last chapter. The first chapter there, verses 2 through 11, and we're going to look at those here in a couple moments. But also we look at that last chapter, the last few verses, kind of bookend and give meaning to the entire book. And there's some stuff that goes in with that. So probably some helpful things in there. Then you'll notice that I've got the outline that's listed here. I wasn't going to put it up on the screen because I've got a lot of points to it. to save some space, I pulled one little subsection out and put it off to the side for that 0.9G just to try to keep us kind of moving along. But this is probably one of the more developed outlines that I'd present with you guys, just because I think the book of Ecclesiastes has a lot of layers to it. And it has a way that it works and a way that it functions. This is from the ESV Study Bible. The more I do outlining and the more I do looking at different parts of the book of the Bible, the more I see that they've done a really good job. So in chapter 1, verses 1 through 3, you have your introduction and theme. And then you start getting into your different points. Point two is the first catalog of vanities, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. The way that the ESV, that's the English Standard Version, translates, one of the key concepts is they use the word vanity. I don't think that's the best translation of it, but we're going to talk about that here in a minute. but nevertheless, we're going to use their language. So that's the first catalog of vanities. And if you skip down to number 5 there, or Roman numeral 5, you'll see that the second catalog of vanities is mentioned. And then you're able to see how the author is working through that. So ultimately, you have that first catalog of vanities, which goes from 1:4 to 2:26. We remember again, Solomon did not, just like the rest of the biblical writers, write in chapter and verse. Solomon put this together on his own and just kind of wrote. The vanity of the natural world, the vanity of wisdom and knowledge, the vanity of pleasures, possessions, and accomplishments. More on vanity of wisdom and vanity of labor. That's kind of the first catalog of vanities. Then we have a poem, A Time for Everything. And if you remember the poem, and there is an occasion for everything and a time for every activity under heaven, a time to give birth and a time to die, a time to plant and uproot, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build. What song is this?
Turn, turn, turn.
Turn, turn, turn. And who is the musicians? Who's that?
Solomon.
Solomon. No. Someone far wiser than Solomon because they were bigger than Jesus. But who was it? The Beatles? The birds? The birds? I don't know. I'm genuine. The birds? Is that who it was? Okay. Yeah, there's that song out there, and it carries with it. It was a little bit more of a, I think, a protest song, but there we go. Thank you, Google. Yes, this is good. Yes, I did get some negative feedback from my sermon on Sunday that I did not make a direct reference to Mike and the Mechanics during, and I used my title, All I Need is a Miracle. Nevertheless, but so you got to know your music, you know, you got to know your good hits. There's a good record store off of Highway 3. You might want to go see if they have one of those. If they don't have it, they can get it for you. Anyways, getting back to the outline. So we see that's a little bit of a set off that very well could have been. And that's a pretty good example of something that might have existed in the literature of the day, something that was sung around the area, the Solomonic Temple or the Solomonic Temple Complex or the palaces. It was a popular ditty or a popular song of the day, and that the author pulled it in, made it part of his text because people would have known it. We see this happening in other places. We see this particularly when Paul goes and confronts and acts the philosophers on the Areopagus. He uses a poem from a secular author of his day. We see this in multiple places around Scripture. It's not surprising, shouldn't be surprising to us. And then talks a little bit about fear God, the sovereign one. Point four is probably one of the central concepts of the book, and that point is fear God. One of the things that you get again and again from Ecclesiastes is that the fear of God is central to our understanding of life. The fear of God. Now, what is the author, which if we believe Solomon wrote Proverbs and wrote Ecclesiastes, what does Proverbs say? The fear of the Lord is the what?
Beginning of wisdom.
Yeah, it's the beginning of those things, the way that we understand of knowledge of those of things that we learn. Again, that concept is carried through. It gives us more position to say this. Hey, this is probably Solomon, or at least in the Solomonic school. Number five, the second catalog of vanities, the vanity of mortal life, the vanity of labor, the vanity of wisdom. Again, recapitulating some themes. Fear God is number six, fear God, the holy righteous one. And then number seven, fear or life under the sun. And what becomes intriguing about this is that within the book of Ecclesiastes, there's a very clear delineation that God is in heaven and man is under the sun. God is above the earth, man is on the earth. And there's some things that happen with that throughout the book. And that's one of the ways that the author, that Solomon, works through those things. You mean God being in heaven? They would have, so this is the hard part about what do they mean by heaven? They don't mean maybe what we mean. There again, this is a pre-scientific culture, so they look up and they just think that God is up. He's in the heavens. In the New Testament, we have a sneaking suspicion, the way we read Paul, that he understood heaven as the stratosphere. I'm gonna mess up all the terms. So like the actual atmosphere, the space, and then a space that's outside of time or space. So last week, a guy took a cheeseburger and put it into orbit. But he didn't make it to space. He just made it really, really high. It almost looks like you can see the curvature of the Earth, and it's dark and all that kind of stuff. And then it came back to Earth, and he did what any 26-year-old who put a cheeseburger into space would do. He ate it. Anyways, it's a funny little story. Yeah. He said it was really stale. He's not sure why. I'm like, well, you put it in the vacuum. But they would have put that concept that God is up above. Again, I'm not as familiar. It's a good question. I'm not as familiar with how Solomon and people of his era would have understood the world. Would it have been more of that flat? We won't want to use the other term, the flatness, but rather that with the different layers up above it, with Hades or Gehenna or Sheol below. But what's intriguing is that in Ecclesiastes, judgment happens to those under the sun, which is an intriguing thing. Like God lives above the sun, so there are multiple layers in there. Though we see elements of the Old Testament referring to the world in kind of a globe context or a spherical context, that isn't always the case. They had very much a very limited understanding because they couldn't put cheeseburgers into orbit. Like, you know, go down to Fry's and get a cheeseburger into orbit kit. You need to attach a balloon to anything, and it'll go anywhere. It would generally go up. But the thing about it is they didn't have that knowledge. So you see how they refer to the passing of the sun, of going up and coming down. They really just understood it just like going up and coming down. They didn't understand the whole process in there. But it's a good question with that. Moving along, and then, so we see the heart of the problem, which is sin, 725 through 729. More on Life Under the Sun, which sounds like a really good book. Wisdom in Dealing with Foolish Authorities, The Importance of Fearing God, The Limits of Human Knowledge, The Unpredictability of Life and Certainty of Death, Finding Enjoyment as Circumstances Allow. This is the really fun part of the book. More on the unpredictability of life, The Paths of Wisdom and Foolishness, The aging and the Vanity of Mortal Life. Under G, we have that little thing to the side there. The Power of Wisdom, Proverbs Concerning Wisdom and Foolishness, and then the Wise Practices of Life and the Wise Practices in Light of the Unpredictability of Life, and then the conclusion and epilogue. This is a pretty good outline. I looked at about five commentaries of increasingly technical nature, and the least of them had 32 different points on how to break out the outline of Ecclesiastes. It is a densely complex book because there's a lot of conversation streams that are going on with that. And different scholars will break up verses in different places because of what they see and how they go through it. So just kind of an overview of the structure about that. Central to Ecclesiastes, and this is getting into the main points that we're going to have for our time that's remaining. Central to Ecclesiastes is the Hebrew word hebel, and is translated vanity, futility, meaningless, or futile, and it carries the idea of vapor, smoke, or breath. So a couple of weeks ago, so this is a fun story I get to tell, a couple of weeks ago when it was really cold outside, our three-year-old, who is, at this point, he's three and a half, and so Jack, and he walked outside with his mom, and he was getting ready to get loaded up to go to school, and he like breathed out, and his breath came out in front of him. Now, had the young man been born, you know, somewhere north of the Mason-Dixon line, this would have been an everyday occurrence. But here in Houston, this is something. And he said he had dragon breath, and he thought it was the coolest thing in the world. So he ran around the car for 3 minutes just breathing out really heavy. But I say that to say, because that's essentially what the author is getting at. It's like on a really, really rare and really, really cold Houston morning, when you breathe out and you see your breath, that's really the idea of Hebel. That is the idea of what the author means. It is that, and trying to put substance around that, that is one of the main words that's used in the book of Ecclesiastes. And it's important because the idea of Hebel that's carried around with it is it is that futility. Now, and we're going to touch on this in a couple moments, but different translations treat this differently and how they approach it. I actually really like the CSB, which is the Christian Standard Bible. It's the one that I primarily preach and teach out of, because it translates it as futility or absolute futility. Ultimately, if I had my druthers, I would translate it as along those lines, along these lines of vapor or smoke or breath and so forth. It's really that fleeting of a concept, and that we try to go after life, we try to go after riches, we try to go after influence, and it's like trying to be a three-year-old on a really cold Houston day and grasping after that so you can put it in your pocket and show other people. Is Solomon being dramatic? Yes. But Solomon, if we understand the book and the biography within the book, is at the end of his life. He's experienced everything that you could experience. He's done everything that you could have done. He's lived the life people have dreamed, and he's come back and he finds it to be absolutely meaningless. A man that will be known for the millennia moving forward, and he says, it's futile, it's meaningless. And the challenge is we see this in our own society. We see this with people that struggle. They want to get insta-famous, or they want to achieve the heights of power, and then they get there. And I remember I was listening to somebody a couple years ago, and they were somebody who was very famous, whose name escapes me. But they were talking about how Sir Anthony Hopkins. I think Anthony Hopkins has achieved quite a lot in his life. And he's the guy that we're all familiar with. He does movies. People come up and offer him lots of money to do movies. His most famous movie, Silence of the Lambs. Probably there's some other ones in there and so forth. A lot of other ones that he's done. He's a significant actor. And what was intriguing is, and this was, I caught it at an interesting point, because I had seen him in the news. He had been driving through California, and he had come to this Catholic college, and he had pulled off, and he just started walking around, because he was having a conversation internally about what things meant. And he encountered some students and talked to them. But I remember in an interview that he gave, he talked about, I've reached the pinnacle of my profession. I was knighted by the Queen of England because of my contributions to acting and to theater and to movies and film and culture. I have my pick of movie scripts that I can do. I don't have to work anymore. I've achieved what everybody dreams of achieving. I've gotten to the places where you've gotten. I've been on top of the mountain, and I got to tell you, I remember he said it, and it was a great way that he said it, which I'm not communicating it nearly as well as he did. And he said, I got to the height of my profession. I accomplished everything, and nobody's there. And nobody's with you, and nobody's around you, and it's meaninglessness. It's that similar sentiment that we see. And I think that's one of the things that drives people like the Gates, Bill and Melinda Gates, their foundation. They're such a unique couple of super uber wealthy people, because their foundation gives away hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And I think it's because they recognize that their legacy is only as good, and their life is only as good as the legacy that they leave. Now, their context is a little bit different than ours, but you see that. What are you going to leave behind? This is the idea behind Ecclesiastes. Ultimately, one cannot escape the tone of Ecclesiastes and the focus of the author, Solomon or Colette, as being dark, depressive, and downcast in his language. You can't look through the book and not see this. You can't look through the book and not just kind of come away with it going, oh, this is tough. It's like reading Job's afflictions and being like, man, this is going to turn out a lot better for him. No, you're like, ah, I resonate with Job. I can't understand what this is like. It's so frustrating. You run into this because of the language of the author of Ecclesiastes. And while the tone of the book appears straightforwardly to be dark, Ecclesiastes has been seen by some as a book of celebration and even being joyful. And one of these people is R. Norman Wybrae, who's written a commentary on Ecclesiastes, and he points to this. I think you guys can see this. Yeah. So he talks about some stuff that happens in the book that he says that kind of in this category, let me pull my little pointer thing up here, in this category where you've got text, this is kind of the downcast nature of the text. So in 112, 112 through 226, these are all the gripes that are happening. And it says, ultimately, pleasure does not satisfy. But and we'll look over, look real quick, we'll just use one or two examples of this. In 224 and 226, but there is nothing better for a person than to eat, drink, and enjoy. Well, technically, I think that King James says, eat, drink, and be merry. In his work, I have seen this is from God's hand, because who can eat and who can enjoy life apart from him? For the person who is pleasing in his sight, he gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy, but to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and accumulating in order to give to the one who is pleasing in God's sight. This too is futile and a pursuit of the wind. But even in that, we capture in 224 and 226, even though that this whole passage right here was talking about how pleasures do not satisfy, yet there is hope for those who pursue God. We see it again. We'll go, well, we're not going to do 3:1 through 3:15, that seasons. Then we get down to 3:12, and it says, I know that there is nothing better for them to rejoice and enjoy the good life. Again, what joy and happiness can be found? Now, Wybrae is basically saying that for every condemnation, there is a spot of hope. For every dark cloud, there's a silver lining. And most commentators push back on Wybrae's notion. I do as well, but because I do think it is an interesting point to bring up, that even in a book that seems so dark and gloomy and cloudy, there is hope. There is possibility. A couple more things. Eden suggests that the book is an apologetic, defending the life of faith in a generous God by pointing to the grimness of the alternative. Ultimately, how do we find hope amid nihilism? And that's really the real big thing. And I actually had a professor one time that talked about how when you break down philosophical schools, there's really two options. Christian theism on the one hand, with God being for us, among us, with us, to us. And then you have Nietzsche, then you have nihilism, you have nothing but death and destruction, and there's a great gulf in between, and you really have these two mountaintops. And that's the thing that he was getting at, was that Christianity as a dogmatic religion, or in terms of a thorough philosophical religion, is perhaps the most well-thought-out theology, philosophical system that's out there. But its counterbalance is nihilism. It's Nietzsche. It is the dark days of the soul. Nietzsche is famous for saying that, to a lesser extent, that this 20th century was going to be laden with warfare and wars, trying to work out the results of the aftermath of his philosophy. And in many ways, it was. And we see that that develops in Germany and then ultimately propagates itself throughout the rest of the world. And we're still dealing with some of the after effects of that, and so forth. Eaton, and he's written the New American Commentary on Ecclesiastes, makes that point. Ultimately, enjoying God's gift among a fallen world is important. We've talked a little bit about this already. What is it that God provides for us? We recognize the fallenness of creation. This is a key point within that in that as well. And the theological message of the book centralizes around the concept of human limitation, the world's corruption, and the need to fear God. What's so intriguing, and this is what another commentator does, is he laid out Ecclesiastes in certain portions, and then he put in the scene in Genesis where Adam and Eve fall, where Adam and Eve go and partake of the tree, and that they ultimately condemn humanity. And they say it's parts of the same kind of fabric. It's kind of the same development, because what we see in Ecclesiastes is futility. It is that concept that we get around to, and so forth. And then we're going to keep moving on here. Let's get through a couple more of these. I'll come back to this. I want to go and dig into a couple passages. Colette also understands humanity as dependent on God for life, but also shows how we are different from God in our limitations. God is eternal. Mankind is not. God lives above the heavens. We live under the sun. And the sun is hot. I really think this was written on like an August day, because they didn't have air conditioning yet. That kind of a thing. For a man of limitless power, Colette laments the reality of human limitation. I think that's something that stands out there. For a man of limitless power, again, reading those passages, I can do whatever I want to because I built whatever I want to with my hands. I think that's extremely important. Move down a little bit. I want to touch on a couple of these within the outline and go back and look at a couple passages. Ultimately, the last kind of that last point to fully understand the book, that's fourth from the bottom. Let me get over to there. To fully understand the book, you have to read the epilogue and see how it fits together. You have to read the back of the book. And if we go back over to there, we go to chapter 12. Let me get to it here. Chapter 12, verses 12 through 14, we see this. And notice what it says. But beyond these, my son, be warned. There is no end to the making of many books, and much study wearies the body. When all has been heard, the conclusion of the matter is this: fear God and keep his commandments, because this is for all humanity. What's the great law in the Old Testament? Fear God and keep his commandments. This is the centrality of it. For God will bring every act into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether good or evil. I think there's really something powerful about that goes on. This is the central idea of the book. You see that at the beginning, and then you see that at the end of the book, and that kind of brings them together. He offers a lot of other illustrations. I mentioned in there, there is something about the concept, I think, of the Trinity that's woven in. For what it's worth, the passage that I mentioned there in 4:12, I've actually... I'm sorry? It is, yeah, 4:12 in Ecclesiastes. Notice what it says here. And if someone overpowers one person, two can resist him. And this is the one that's really significant, the clause that's really significant. A cord of three strands is not easily broken. I've used this illustration when I've talked with Muslim counterparts and Muslim friends about the nature of the Trinity. The Trinity, the idea there that a cord of three strands, all strands being equal, strands being woven together, strands now being able to hold more, is an illustration. It's not the perfect picture of the Trinity, but it's an illustration, in my opinion, of the Trinity. I throw that out there because you never know. But ultimately, in summation, through the book, we see that through Solomon's life, we can see Mark 8:36 on display. What does it profit a person to gain the whole world, yet forfeit his soul? What does it gain a person? What does it profit a person to gain the whole world, yet forfeit his soul? At the end of his days, Solomon is left asking the question, what do I do this for? And this is kind of a thought that I had many years ago. You can have all the wisdom, wealth, and women, but end up with worthlessness. Because that's where Solomon ends up with that. And along those lines, let's look back real quick, and let's look real quick at these couple verses. This is, for me, as I look through the book, verses 2 through 11 of chapter 1 are really critical to the identity of the book. They really become the motto, is what some commentators call it. And you'll notice this. So, and we'll talk about this real quick, and then we'll wrap up for the evening. Absolute futility, says the teacher. Absolute futility. Everything is futile. And we'll keep going. Verse 3. What does a person gain for all his efforts that he labors at under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets. Panting, it returns to the place where it rises. It's an interesting way to describe the sun rising, the sun setting. Nevertheless, verse 6, gusting to the south, turning to the north, turning goes the wind, and the wind returns to in its cycles. This first section of it, let me just go ahead and finish the 7. And then all the streams flow to the sea, yet the sea is never full, to the place where the streams flow, where they flow again. All things are wearisome, more than anyone can say. The eye is not satisfied by seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Can one say about anything, look, this is new? It has already existed in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of those who came before, and of those who will come after, there will be no remembrance by those who follow them. This is the happy-go-lucky part of the book of Ecclesiastes right off the bat. We notice a couple things in Solomon's, sort of his conversation that he gets into. One of the first things is that we see that he immediately begins using these terms, absolute futility, absolute futility. This is that term that I mentioned, Hebel, that exists in Ecclesiastes. That is really a summation. Hebel exists 32 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. In 13 passages, it's used to characterize false idols. Everywhere else, and so they can be translated as false. Everywhere else, it carries the idea of meaninglessness or vapor or vanity. But it is that central concept. Also notice a couple of the things that's going on here in the book, or at least in this chapter. We begin noticing that he uses these key concepts about nature. He talks about the sun coming and going. He talks about the wind coming and going, the wind returning to its cycles. This is very much Solomonic agricultural, or at least natural imagery that he uses to try to explain his points. Go back to the book of Proverbs, and you'll see again and again, nature is woven into, used as an illustration, and he's using this. Now, we see a little bit more here about the nature of the sun, but this term right here is really intriguing, this idea of cycles. The philosophy of history, which is a fun conversation, in the ancient world is very much one of cycles. It's not a linear progression. So we think of a history a lot of times in terms of a linear progression. That we go from point A to point B to point C to point D. The Revolutionary War existed in this period. It was followed by the Confederated States of America and the Articles of Confederation, which didn't work, so it was followed by the Constitution, which worked pretty good for now. And then we had, you know, all this other stuff that came in. The War of 1812 happened. Da-da-da-da-da-da. All this other stuff is going on. We think very linearly about history. In the ancient world, they thought about history in terms of cycles, and they thought about history as being kind of this cyclical pattern. It's a very much an agricultural way of looking at how history works. It's cyclical. You can't get out of the cycles. And this cycle of history has a lot to do with how you understand the world. Solomon uses that, and he really is leveraging that. Listen, you can come into this world, you can do all these things, but the world's ultimately going to eat you up. The world's ultimately going to pass you by. And we see that even more so in verses 7 through 8, because we see that the idea of the streams filling the sea. We don't know where the water comes from, but they never stop. And we see again, all things are wearisome. more than anyone can say. Ultimately, this motto or this big idea for the book leaves you to a place where you're left with saying, well, what else can I do? What else can I be? How can I see hope? And in many ways, we see hopelessness in Ecclesiastes. But then if we go back to the epilogue, we go back to the conclusion of the book, and we see again, when all has been heard, the many conclusions of this matter is this: fear God and keep his commands, because this is for all humanity. Fear God and keep his commands. And that is the heart of really how you see things work themselves out. There's not a lot of hope in Ecclesiastes at your first reading, but when we dig into it a little bit deeper, we find that there's still hope, and it's pursuing after God, it's pursuing after his ways, and through that we find freedom from the patterns of this world to seek to overcome us. And that's ultimately where Solomon is getting at. And there's a lot more to be said about that. I've got some more notes in there. You can read through some of those as well. But any other things, any other thoughts, any other questions? He'll be here on Sunday, I believe. Sure.
Is this the basis of the religion in India, of the cycle?
India still carries through the sort of that cyclical view. If you go and you talk with them, our resident scholar of India, we should say, is Aaron Glenn, and you might want to talk to him about it. But very much the Hinduism that's in there, it's very much that cycle of life. It's very much that cyclical pattern. A lot of that cyclical pattern is based on, because what's your primary metaphor growing up, even in Solomon's time? It's the pattern of planting and harvesting. It's that the idea that there's always just that season. It comes and goes, comes and goes, comes and goes. Got to get your seed into the ground so you can get a harvest, so you can last for the next planting and harvest. So you can last the next planting and harvest. It's very much that cyclical pattern that gets in there. But yeah, I think that what happens is that ideology still permeates in a lot of places. India being one of them. They're very much, and it's not that they're primitive. They're rather advanced society, but just kind of their worldview as a whole, which some of that comes from the Hinduism that's in there. So that's a little bit of that. I think it's a good observation, Todd. Yeah.
I think Yogin is a good example
of Solomon. Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. Judges is another book that uses a cyclical pattern, that whole idea of rebellion, sin, rebellion, judgment, restoration, sin, rebellion, judgment, restoration. And then the big idea for Judges is everyone did what they thought was right in their own eyes. And it's very similar. It's almost kind of like the narrative portion of Ecclesiastes, the wisdom literature, for sure.